our speaker, Stu Kaufman. There's a lot of rhetoric about interdisciplinarity and the benefits of being on the edge of the field and between different fields and so forth. But I don't think I know anybody who quite has lived that and exemplifies that besides Stu. Stu Kaufman is trained as a medical doctor. And shortly after, I think after medical school, he also has some training in philosophy. And shortly after medical school, and I don't know quite the story, but thinking about how a cell works, invented a statistical mechanical model called KN networks, or sometimes Kaufman networks, that had enough meat in it that it's been a subject of study by physicists for 30-something years, and there are many papers by people in statistical mechanics and so forth about it. And that's just in a very small part of students' kind of contributions and creativity. The fact that there is a contemporary field of theoretical biology which really tries to understand fundamental questions like what is life, what is the cell, how does evolution work, and the fact that growing out of that there's a study of complex systems with some search for general principles, whether they have to do with those questions, biology or earthquakes or questions about how the economy works or many, many other things, is due to a small number of people, and Stu is one of those people. And Stu is also, has a lot of, it's great to welcome him here because he has a lot of experience with what we've done here, which is starting new scientific institutes, new arenas for people to do science. And Stu has many, many interests and accomplishments, so I'm not going to list them all. Why is he giving this talk? Stu is completely fearless and has, among his interests, have been philosophical issues about the nature of science, about reductionism, about the nature, sometimes spilling over to the nature of quantum mechanics, although they'll say I'm just a fruit fly geneticist, I don't know any quantum mechanics. That may be true, I'm not sure, but he is somebody who's been thinking relentlessly about some of the key foundational issues in physics and in science, and it's a wonderful thing to have him here to provoke us.
Thank you, Lee. Well, I'm really very glad to be here. I guess this is the second time that I've talked at the Perimeter Institute. The reason I'm glad is that I want to talk to you about things that I think are really radical. And you're a really good audience to say whether or not you think there's some merit in what I'm saying or not. And I expect that many of you will be strongly opposed, which is fine. I'm going to criticize reductionism. The most radical thing I'm going to say is that I do not think that there are sufficient laws that are sufficient, to describe the evolution of the biosphere or the economy or cultural evolution. And if that's right, and I'll come to a crux moment partway through my talk where I'll ask you a question. I'll be perfectly serious about it. And if you answer as right now thousands of people have, it seems to lead to the conclusion that I just said. I've entitled this talk The Open Universe, and the quick and dirty version of it is the following. I do not think that the human heart is entailed by the laws of physics. The existence in the universe I should be careful. I do not think that the existence in the universe of the human heart is entailed by the laws of physics. You may all disagree with me. If it's not, then why there are human hearts and butterflies and trees and Series B preferred stock become matters to be explained in a rather different way than we've tried it. So let me begin, if I may, with a very simple version of reductionism, which you all know. Here's Laplace with his massive demon, with a massive intelligence. And says Laplace, were this demon to know the positions and momenta of all the particles in the universe, then using Newton's laws, the demon can compute the entire future and the entire past of the universe, because Newton's laws, as everybody knows, are time reversible. I at first thought that there were only three features of Laplace's statement that required comment. I've since realized, since I've been introduced to the philosopher Rorty, that there are four features that require comment, if not more. The first is that in this view, the evolution of the universe is entirely deterministic because, of course, Newton's laws are deterministic. A century later, given quantum mechanics, the Copenhagen interpretation, and the Born rule, one casts doubt on that. And I, too, know that there are alternative interpretations of quantum mechanics, not as well as you guys do. I'm using guys in the non-sexual sense. But I am a doctor, and if any of you guys are pregnant, I can deliver a baby. Particularly for the guys, okay? I think I could still deliver a baby pretty well. It's been a long time, but I delivered a lot of them. They just fall. Well, it is a catching thing, Nick. I mean, what you do is that the typically woman, but not always, okay, is there up in the stirrups and she pushes and the baby comes. You don't like it? Oh. That's okay. I mean, it's delivering babies. It's called obstetrics. Okay, so thing one is the it's okay, Lee. I mean, there's nothing wrong with obstetrics. So determinism is cast in doubt by the standard interpretation of quantum mechanics. The second, and through the 20th century, most fundamental thing in Laplace's claim is that what is real in the universe is nothing but particles in motion. It's Democritus, okay? It's the nothing but view of reductionism, in which a man found guilty of murder right here in Waterloo is nothing but particles in motion. The third is the claim that everything that happens in the universe is describable by natural law. This is what I shall most radically challenge. And the fourth, I realized on reading philosopher Rorty, is that there exists at least one language which suffices to describe all of reality. Namely, in this case, namely Newton's laws, okay, and particles in motion. I don't know the answer to Rorty's worry, but if you start thinking about it, it's not obviously true that there should be a language that's capable of describing all of reality. And let's just kind of hold that there and be disturbed by it. Okay. Now, you guys all know physics, and I don't, but roughly speaking, if you add fields and quantum mechanics and general relativity and the standard model and what everybody in this room does, except a few of us, you get to modern physics. So the first thing to be said about the reductionist stance is that superb physicists continue to hold the reductionist stance. And I will mention Steven Weinberg, with whom I've been in email contact. I've never met him. I'd love to meet him. My colleague at the Santa Fe Institute, Murray Gell-Mann, who is a devout reductionist. And I think David Gross, who's an old, fairly friendly acquaintance, is a confirmed reductionist. David Gross of the Nobel laureate of the Kepler Institute. David, I think, is a reductionist. But starting in 1972, Phil Anderson, another, I mean, excuse me for dropping Nobel laureates around like little ping pong balls, but it's an argument, you know, from authority. Okay, so, and the point is to tell you that really smart physicists also doubt reductionism. So Phil, who's a, it tends to be inversely correlated with the number of broken symmetries. Okay, so Phil's a solid state physicist, and he says everything's a mess. And he wrote a paper in 1972 called "More Is Different," in which he argued, and I won't give his arguments, that reductionism is insufficient, that there are properties that cannot be explained from the bottom up. Another person who's held this view, I'm going to give you three, because I found a third through the doodle-lee yesterday. A second person is Robert Lachman, another Nobel laureate, who's written a book, A Different Universe, The Universe from the Bottom Down. So you can argue with him. I'll just tell you some of the things he says. He says, look, an iron atom isn't rigid, but an iron bar is. And roughly speaking, he wants to say that this is an emergent property, and that the characteristic of it is that the more of it you got, the more accurately you can measure it. And he could have talked about temperature, for example, as another, and does, as another example. The second thing that he talks about are what he calls laws of organization. And I'm going to give you an example because it happens to be one that I invented. But first, a third thing that he talks about, which I don't understand yet, is a view of his that the fundamental laws of physics are themselves emergent. I dearly would like to know what Bob Lachman is thinking. Maybe some of you do, and I'd love to hear it. Anyway, he has in view what he calls laws of organization. Let me give you one, and it's one that I invented. So it's a theory of the origin of molecular reproduction. And it works just fine on a computer. It's been shown analytically. It's been partially shown experimentally. So this is about 1971, and DNA was known. And you all know it's the famous double helix. Anybody interested in how life could start couldn't help but fall in love with the beautiful symmetry of the double helix and think, well, life has to be based on polynucleotide and polynucleotide replication, and I think most of you know how you do it. You unzip the ladder sides and make copies of the... Watson makes a copy of the Crick strand, and Crick strand makes a copy of the Watson strand, and they don't like it if you say that, but Crick's dead and Watson's too arrogant to pay much attention. And my response when I saw that was to say, I'll really tell you what I thought. I thought, suppose, not knowing what I meant, what if the laws of physics were a little different and nitrogen didn't have five bonds? Would life be impossible? And I just didn't want it to be true because it seems, I mean, the molecule seems too special. So I thought to myself, what's the fundamentals of life? The fundamentals of life are you eat some stuff, and there's some building blocks, and then chemical reactions happen. Then you speed up chemical reactions by catalysis. For those of you who aren't chemists, and there's at least one in the room who is, remember that catalysts do not shift the equilibrium of a reaction. They hasten getting to the equilibrium. And catalysis means that what's happening is under kinetic control. Okay, because you've been speeding up things. Then I thought what you need is a set of molecules that catalyzes its own formation. So before I go into the theory, let me tell you that reproducing cells are what I will call collectively autocatalytic. Okay, every molecule in your cell gets its formation catalyzed by one or more other molecules in the cell. There's no molecule in your cell that catalyzes its own formation. It's a set that achieves catalytic closure. I catalyze your formation, you catalyze Bill's formation, and Bill catalyzes my formation out of parts. So it achieves a catalytic closure as a set, okay? So first let me tell you what's been done experimentally. Gunter von Kitarowski some years ago took a single-stranded DNA molecule with six nucleotides and he took three nucleotides, two trimers, that Wasson-Crick hydrogen bonded to the hexamer, and then they formed a proper bond between them called a phosphodiester bond, and they happened to be identical to the hexamer. So he made the first self-reproducing molecular system. By the way, to back up, just to tell you a little bit of chemistry, people have now tried for 50 years to get a single-stranded DNA or RNA molecule to line up free nucleotides, ligate them together with proper 3', 5' phosphodiester bonds, then melt apart and cycle again. It's never worked. Maybe it'll work, okay? But really good chemists have tried, and people are giving up on it. It's the most obvious thing to think, and that's why people thought it and did it. It doesn't work. Maybe it will, but it doesn't. Anyway, Gunther, having made an single autocatalytic DNA molecule, length 6, made two, where hexamer A catalyzes the formation of hexamer B out of B parts, and hexamer B catalyzes the formation of hexamer A out of A parts. So collective autocatalysis with DNA molecules is a done deal. Finished. Been done. The truly exciting thing has to do with proteins. So let me tell you about proteins. Proteins are made of amino acids, and there's 20 kinds in a biological protein, and they line up like 20 colored beads on a string. And then the thing folds up into some shape and becomes hemoglobin or an enzyme or something in your body. And it doesn't have this gorgeous symmetry of the double-stranded DNA molecule, so it's not obvious how a protein could reproduce itself, and nobody thought it was possible, except dumb me. And I thought, well, why couldn't you have a protein that catalyzed the ligation of two proteins to make a bigger protein that became a catalyst to ligate the formation of two littler proteins to make a big protein, where the two big proteins were A and B and make a collectively autocatalytic set. You see the idea. Reza Gadiri has done it about 6 years ago. So what Reza did is he took a 32-long amino acid sequence from a particular protein that makes an alpha helix, and then it coils back on itself. It's called a coiled coil. And as they say in their articles, he reasoned that, which means he lucked. Actually, he's smart. He did reason that. But if you took this 32-long amino acid sequence and confronted it with two fragments of a second copy of itself, 15-long and 17-long, the 32-long guy would line up the two fragments and then bind them together by a proper peptide bond. And it works like a charm. So Gunther demonstrated forever that you can make molecular reproducing systems without using DNA, that a peptide can do it. Then, garbage. Okay, Reza. Okay. You're right, it is Reza. And he's at Scripps. So then Reza took two peptides, A and B, and A glues together two fragments of B to make B, and B glues together two fragments of A to make A. And I want you to feel, once again, this is a collectively autocatalytic system. No molecule in the system catalyzes its own formation. Okay? It achieves catalytic closure. So here's Stu's theory, done initially in 1971, and then I came back to it in about 83, I guess. And it really goes like this. I'll just give you the feeling for it. Have a space of molecules. Now, let these molecules undergo reactions, and now ask, can these molecules catalyze any of the reactions? Well, peptides can undergo reactions. They can glue together and break apart, and peptides can catalyze reactions. They're enzymes, okay? So now make a theory in which you have a set of molecules, a set of reactions, and some probability distribution over the set of molecules about what molecules catalyze what reactions. The key idea is that the diversity of molecules increases, the diversity of reactions among them increases much faster. So that under a wide variety of hypotheses about which molecules catalyze which reactions, eventually you catalyze so many reactions that you get a phase transition in the reaction graph that's the analog of the famous Erdős-Renyi phase transition in just a graph to a giant component. Namely, you get a huge connected set of catalyzed reactions. And generically, what happens is that the set of catalyzed reactions is autocatalytic. That is to say, the set catalyzes all the reactions that is needed to make the molecules that catalyze the reactions that make the set. So essentially, with probability one, at a sufficient diversity, you'll get autocatalytic sets. And it works. And we've shown the phase transition analytically, we've shown it numerically. We can now try to do it experimentally because you can now make random peptides by making random DNA, random RNA, and random peptides, which a student of mine showed folds. And so within 10 or 15 years, we'll know whether or not it'll work experimentally, either with DNA, I mean, either with RNA or with peptides or with both or some other molecules. Now, here's the point. The ideas that I just told you were essentially mathematical. There are things called molecules, there's things called reactions, and there's things called catalysis. And it's now a mathematical theory that under a wide variety of assumptions about the molecule thingies and the reaction thingies, eventually you're going to get a catalyzed reaction graph that closes on itself. Everybody hear it? That's the mathematics. It doesn't care about the underlying physics. It's a mathematical theory, yeah?
So what is the parameter that governs the phase?
Is it the number of reactions or the strength of the reaction or something?
Yeah, I'll say it fast, but I have a lot to say, so I'd prefer if you held questions to the end. But just, no, that's okay. So what goes into this model is the kind of reactions that can happen, which governs the ratio of reactions to molecules, okay? For example, you could have ligation and cleavage, or you could have two substrate, two product reactions. They have very different ratios of reactions to molecules. And then the distribution of catalytic capacities among the molecules and how you assign it. And for a wide variety of the latter, it falls out that the generic property over this class of hypotheses about who catalyzes what, you simply get an autocatalytic set popping out at a sufficient diversity of molecules and therefore a sufficiently high ratio of reactions to molecules. You just catalyze so many reactions that you get connected pathways among all molecules. So is the idea clear? You can see that it's a mathematical idea. It's precisely Bob Laughlin's notion of a law of organization. Of course it has to be instantiated by some specific molecules or something that you call molecules. They don't have to be. They could be, for all I care, fads in a culture. Okay? You could have the same idea. It doesn't matter what the things are. There's this law of organization that one's talking about. And I call them an autocatalytic set. So here's what I think is true. If I give you an autocatalytic set of peptides, I think that in principle, you physicists can work out why it works. It's actually pretty hard, but in principle, I don't think there's anything magical going on. The point is that the theory of autocatalytic sets, Stu's most excellent theory, you will remember when one said most excellent, Stu's most excellent theory of autocatalytic sets is independent of physics. Okay? It's not reducible to quantum physics. It has nothing to do with quantum physics. It's a story about dots and arrows and lines and stuff like that. So it's one of the laws of organization of the kind that Laughlin talked about. So I think it stands independent of physics. I'm going to give you a third example, which I just got yesterday, and I forgot to bring it down with me. Lee gave me a paper yesterday called More is Really Different, and you will remember the person who was here at Perimeter. And I don't know if many of you have read it. I read it last night. Let me tell you roughly what it says, and you can read it more accurately than I can. The authors say the following. They map a Turing machine onto a 2D infinite Ising lattice, and then they show that you can encode it in such a way that since it's a universal Turing machine, there's lots of features of it that are formally undecidable. And their point is that even if you know the underlying physics of the spin-spin couplings, there's no way whatsoever to deduce the formally undecidable properties, which now are physically meaningful, like average magnetization and stuff like that. Now, if they're right, their claim is, just because you know the underlying laws, doesn't mean you can deduce or infer the macroscopic properties. I would like to hear a critique by competent physicists about whether or not that's to be believed. But it's another notion that leads in the same direction, that you can't get from down here to up here. So that's the physicists. Now I'm going to tell you that I, as a biologist, don't think you can reduce biology to physics. First, let me tell you what I'm not going to claim. I think that if you knew all of the parts of your heart, or my heart, I'll be the guinea pig, that in principle, of course, you can't get to water, but leaving out the fact that you can't get to water, in principle, you could work out how all the properties of my heart. I don't think there's anything mystical whatsoever going on. So let me grant that. Now let's ask Darwin. Mr. Darwin, what's the function of the human heart? And we all know what he'd say. He'd say it's to pump blood. Then you might say to him, but Mr. Darwin, the heart makes heart sounds, and it wiggles water in your pericardial sac. It's true. And he'd say, yeah, but that's not the function of the heart. The function of the heart is to pump blood. And then he'd say, the reason I know that is that the heart was selected by natural selection, and everybody knows what natural selection is. You all know heritable variation and natural selection. He'd say the heart was selected to pump blood. And importantly, and I'll come back to this, that's why hearts exist in the universe, because they were selected to pump blood. First thing to notice is that the function of the heart, notice that function, in this sense of function, is not a word in physics. Happenings are words in physics, not functions. Okay, so we're into a different language game in the Wittgensteinian sense, or something else, once we're at organisms. So here's problem number one. The function of the heart is a subset of its properties. It's the pumping of blood, not making heart sounds or water wiggling in the pericardial sac. So when Weinberg deduces all the properties of the heart, he has no way whatsoever to pick out pumping blood as being particularly interesting. It's just another property of the heart. Okay? Can't say. To say, assuming that Darwin's right, what Weinberg has to do is give an account of the evolution of the biosphere such that the heart came into existence by natural selection. So I'm going to say that he can't do that. But first I want to pause and talk about something that is why I titled this talk, The Open Universe. I mean, one hypothesis is that the way out there, wherever out there is, there's little holes at the edge, but I don't really think that. Okay, so that's not what I mean by the open universe. Let's think of the number of proteins that are possible with 200 amino acids in them. Well, there's 20 kinds of amino acids, so the answer is 20 to the 200th, which is about 10 to the 260th. There's about 10 to the 80th particles in the universe. Forget the fact that they're separated from one another. And imagine that on the Planck time scale, nothing was going on but making proteins length 200, which of course is not possible, but imagine it. Then it turns out it would take 10 to the 39th times the lifetime of the universe to make all proteins length 200 once. Now this is really important physically. I want to convey that it's important physically. It means that at levels of complexity above the atom, and leaving out other aspects of the evolution of the universe, but at levels of complexity above the atom, the universe is grotesquely non-ergodic. We are on some unique trajectory, and we will not make most complex things in the lifetime of the universe. We will not make most complex molecules. We will not make most possible organisms. We will not make, but are trying to make, all possible Chevrolets. We will not make, as Roberto Unger says, all possible social systems, as if we could even conceive of what that is, a point I'll come back to. Okay? And it's in this sense that I mean that the universe is open. It's indefinitely open upward, and we haven't thought about it. Okay? I mean, there's the Eiffel Tower out there. That's part of the universe. We're indefinitely open upward. I don't know what I mean by indefinite, but it's big. Now, it's in that context that the heart is of interest, because you see, when the space of the possible is much larger than what will actually happen, history enters. we can get into debates about how history matters to manage a standard, and we will in a minute, because we all know about deterministic chaos, we all know about quantum theory and the Copenhagen interpretation. I'm going to give you something more radical in a moment, but we could play with just that. Okay, so I will try to give you now two arguments in two parts about why I don't think that that the reductive physicist can explain the coming into existence in the biosphere of the human heart. Not the working of it once it exists. It's this organized thing in you that pumps blood. So it's an organization of matter, energy, process, work, power, a lot of stuff. Well, one way you could try to do it would be to start at some point, like the Big Bang or the formation of the Earth or the first living thing, and try to deduce the evolution of the heart. I'm going to try to show you in a few minutes that I don't think you can do that. So put that side of the argument to the side. The other way you could try to do it is you could try to simulate it. Well, I don't think you can, because quantum mechanics matters, and some cosmic ray arrives from somewhere and causes a mutation in some early organism, and a heart starts to evolve. Okay? Could we simulate it? Well, I don't see how. I mean, it looks to me like you'd have to do an infinite number of simulations. Even if you could do this infinite number of simulations, well, I could get more precise about it, but I think you see the intuition. How would you ever know that you were right? I mean, how would you ever know that you got all the precise quantum events that have happened in the evolution of the biosphere right, so that you could account and say, yeah, this is the one that gave rise to this biosphere? How would you know? There's no way you could ever confirm it. So it's at least epistemologically utterly beyond reach. So I don't think you can know that way. And then I'll get to can you deduce it otherwise. Now I'm going to make, so at least epistemologically, if you want to buy the epistemological ontological distinction, and I'm not sure that I do, there's no way you can do it. I think physics is out of luck. You just can't drive it by simulations. Then what I want to say is a little bit contentious. I want to say that things like hearts that have come to exist in the universe and have causal powers of their own are ontologically real. So I don't want to hang much weight on this, but I think hearts are real things, and I think me being found guilty of murder is a real thing in the universe, but I hope it doesn't happen. And that therefore the nothing but view of reductionism, that we're nothing but particles in motion, doesn't stand. I'm going to wait for a moment to get to Weinberg and entailing, because I now want to come to the third claim, that everything that happens in the universe is describable by a natural law. I think everybody in this room believes that. I no longer do. We've believed it since Descartes and Galileo and Newton and Einstein and Schrodinger. If it's wrong, it's really important. So I'm going to tell you stuff that may persuade you, but then it's worth examining to see whether or not I'm right. I may very well be wrong. So I'm going to start talking about something that Darwin didn't call it this, but it's now called a Darwinian pre-adaptation. And the great paleontologist Stephen Jay Gould called it an exaptation, because pre-adaptation sounds like somebody was designing it ahead of time, and that's not what Darwin meant. What Darwin meant was the following. He said, you know, a property of an organism of no selective use whatsoever in the current environment, say like wiggling water in your pericardial sac, your heart, so doing, might turn out to be useful in some funny environment, so be selected. So it's not that there was any pre-design, it just turns out that it's useful. I'm sure you all see the idea. So I'm going to give you three examples. The first two are biological. The last one's technological. Some organisms, some fish, have an organ called a swim bladder. It's a sac, partially filled with air, partially filled with water, The level of water in the sac determines neutral buoyancy in the water column, and it also helps because the water's on the bottom to keep the fish upright. Here's how paleontologists think that the swim bladder arose. There are fish with lungs called lungfish, and they flop from puddle to puddle, breathing as they go. The evidence seems to suggest that water got into the lungs of some lungfish, and now you have a sack partially filled with air, partially filled with water, and anybody can see that it's kind of on its way to being a swim bladder. It's sort of poised to become a swim bladder. So that's how swim bladders are supposed to have come about. So I'm going to start with two questions, then go on to my second biological example. Did a new function come to exist in the biosphere, neutral buoyancy in the water column? Well, yeah. Does anybody doubt it? Okay, we all agree, right? Did it have propagating consequences? This is a really deep issue, propagating consequences. Because one of the questions is going to be, what does it take to have propagating consequences? Life and the evolution of the biosphere has it. Is there anything special about life? I don't know, but life does it. Did it have propagating consequences for the evolution of the biosphere? Sure. New species, new niches, new proteins, new kinds of molecules, all sorts of things. So it had propagating consequences for the evolution of the biosphere. So it mattered to the physical structure of the universe. Molecules came into existence, and organs came into existence, and species came into existence that otherwise would not have, if one can use a counterfactual. So it mattered to the physical makeup of the universe, in the non-ergodic universe, where complex things come to exist at most won't. Okay, now I'm going to give you a second example. You all have three bones in your middle ear, incus, stapes, and malleus, that transmit sound from your eardrum to your inner ear. They arose in evolution from three adjacent jaw bones in an early teleost fish that were adjacent to one another, and they morphed into the middle ear bones of your ear. Once again, did a new function come to exist in the biosphere called hearing? Sure. Did it matter to the evolution of the biosphere? Sure. New species, all the stuff that I just said before. So it had propagating consequences, fair enough. Next point I want to make is it was important that the three jaw bones were next to one another. Had one been in the jaw, one had been in the skull, and one been in the spine, they probably would never have come together to make the middle ear bones. And we don't know that, but almost certainly, right? So what you guys might want to call relational degrees of freedom, the relationships among things, here's spatial matter. Okay. Now I'm going to get to my question. You get to answer yes or no. Do you think you could say ahead of time all possible Darwinian pre-adaptations for all organisms alive now? Well, you say, oh, look, we don't know all organisms alive now. And I'll say, okay, what about just humans? Anybody think you can say now? Or, you know, in the next month, or a year, or a decade? All possible Darwinian pre-adaptations that can happen for humans. We all specify what they are. Yeah. Can you specify all possible Darwinian pre-adaptations?
Do you mean in principle or given what we know right now?
Given what we know right now.
Clearly not.
Okay. I don't know what you mean by in principle.
Well, a reductionist would say if you gave me enough information, if I knew enough about the laws of physics, maybe I could. But we clearly don't know that now, so clearly the answer has to be no. This is why I don't fully understand the thrust of the question.
Neat. So you're going to defend reductionism, and we'll come back and argue about it. Okay, so let me have the thrust of my question, and then we can come back and fight it. Okay. I think we all agree that we can't say it. Okay. What you've just said is, if the universe is lawful, and if we knew the laws, we could, in fact, in principle, deduce it. Okay? That's what's buried in what you've just said. And Weinberg would say, in a strong sense, that physics entails the coming into existence of the swim bladder. I don't think it does. Okay? And as a matter of fact, more is really different is the first piece of work that I've seen that seems to argue against it. It seems to say that if you can map a Turing machine onto 2D, that it's infinite, but it's infinite, spin lattice, then there are macroscopic properties that you can't derive from the microscopic properties. But you guys should read the paper and see what you think of it. Okay, but it's a neat paper, particularly if it's right, particularly if the infinity doesn't matter to the argument.
Who's it by?
Who's the...
So this is the people, Michael Nielsen.
This is people who, Nate Michael Nielsen, Christian Weinbrook, and another person.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I was going to make copies to bring them in and the archive number, but obviously you've got it.
I was involved with
the
discussion.
Okay, so you can defend it or not. Okay.
It's quite a good paper.
Okay, so now... Good.
I'm not on the paper.
Good, good. So... we all agree that you can't say it. Now let me define the adjacent possible of the biosphere. I can define it very precisely for a chemical reaction system. Let me do it there first. Put 1,000 organic molecules into a pot. Have a good organic chemist, let them be organic molecules. Have a good chemist tell you all the possible reactions they can undergo. Call the set of reaction molecules you started with the actual. Now, look at all of the possible reactions that can happen and ask what all of the products are and ask, are there any members of the product set that are new, that weren't in the initial set? Call that the adjacent possible. Okay? So it's perfectly defined under given reaction conditions and some given definition of the stability of a molecular species. Okay? So there I know what I'm talking about because I know what I mean by a molecule. Okay? A molecule is some bound state of a bunch of nuclei and electron clouds and stuff like that. And I can say words like that because I've heard them from my friend. Okay, so I know what I'm, and you know what I'm talking about. Okay, then I want to say in some rough sense that once there's lungfish, the swim bladder is in the adjacent possible of the biosphere. But before there are multicelled organisms, namely 3 billion years ago, it's not in the adjacent possible of the biosphere. Without knowing exactly what I mean by adjacent, but sort of nearby. I think what we've just agreed to is that we don't know how to describe the adjacent possible of the biosphere. We haven't the faintest idea. Think about it. We haven't the faintest idea how to describe what's in the adjacent possible of the biosphere. Okay? Nothing. Okay, now, let's look at the implications of this. And by the way, I realized something. I came up with an argument last night knowing that I was going to face you. And it was my first chance to try this particular little piece of the argument, but I like it. Let me give you the parts that I've thought about quite a bit. The first one is can we make a probability statement about the emergence of a Darwinian pre-adaptation? And I'm going to say we can't. So let's flip a coin 10,000 times. Comes up heads. Don't count edges. Okay. Comes up heads. About 500 times with a binomial distribution. But we could say ahead of time what the set of all the possible outcomes was, right? You say all heads, all tails, all 2^10,000 possibilities. That is to say, we knew the sample space of the process, so we could construct a frequency interpretation of probability theory distribution of the outcomes in front of us. We knew the sample space. We don't for the evolution of the biosphere. We haven't the faintest idea what the adjacent possible of the biosphere is. We can't say it. We don't have any words for it. We have no notion whatsoever what it is. Now let's try Laplace. And he said, you know, if you're in front of N doors and you know that there's a treasure behind one of them, your chance of picking the right door is 1 over N. And that becomes the foundation for Bayesian statistics, where you have unequal priors rather than equal priors over the N doors. But notice that Laplace knew what N was. We don't know what N is. So I want to say, first of all, we can't make a statistical statement about the evolution of the biosphere by Darwinian pre-adaptations. Now, not all biological evolution is Darwinian pre-adaptation, but they happen all the time, okay? In evolution. They're not rare. And now let me give you, by the way, I'll take a moment and give it to you in the economy. So some guys are trying to invent a tractor. This is supposed to be a true story. Let's believe it's a true story because it's too cute to not want to believe it's a true story. And it's a Texas story because of Bush. And so it's a, they think we're going to need a really big engine block, and they get this really big engine block, and they say, well, let's put it on a chassis, and it breaks the chassis. So they put it on a bigger chassis, and it breaks the chassis. And they put it on a bigger chassis, and it breaks the chassis. And they keep going. And finally, one of the engineers says, you know, the engine block's so big and rigid, we can use the engine block itself as a chassis and hang everything off the engine block. That's how they talk in Texas. They don't, actually. But something like that. That's a Darwinian pre-adaptation. It's using a causal property of the engine block, its rigidity, for a new function, namely to be a chassis, right? Do you think you could say ahead of time all possible novel functionalities of all of our artifacts? You feel like no. Let me go back and say a little bit about what I think the problem is. There's at least two problems, at least two. How would we state ahead of time what all possible selective conditions are? And how would we know we'd completed the list? I got no idea. How would we state ahead of time the features within one organism, like the three adjacent jawbones, or features among different organisms of the same or different species that might become the subjects of Darwinian pre-adaptation and be molded into some novel functionality? How will we pre-identify them? We seem utterly befuddled. We have no way of getting started. Okay? Now, that's a statistical statement. So now let me get to the law part. What's a law? So my expert on this is Murray Gell-Mann. And Murray says, and I think perfectly simple, well, you either think that laws govern or you think they describe. And I assume we all think that they describe. So most people then say natural laws are compact descriptions of the regularities of a process. I'm going to get to non-compact descriptions in a minute. But suppose that a law is a compact description of the regularities of a process. Then can we have a natural law which is a sufficient description of the evolution of swim bladders? No. We can't even pre-state the possibility, let alone calculate the probability, let alone have a law. So we can't. And this is the part of my argument that says laws do not sufficiently describe the evolution of the biosphere. I don't think they do. I don't think they do. I don't think the evolution of the swim bladder is entailed by physics, by your physics. I think we have to invent a new physics, okay? I think we have to lift physics up to biology, okay? But we're going to have to deal with this. So if this is right, it says we can't do what Newton said to do. So I really want to get this image across to you. It's bizarre. So we say to Newton, look, I wonder what the billiard balls are going to do on the table. And he said, look, it's simple. Look at the positions and the momenta of all of these balls and look at sort of their sizes and kind of the shape of the table and the boundary conditions. So get the initial and the boundary conditions. And I just came up with these cool laws and just calculate. I just invented the calculus. What are you worried about? And it works. Of course, it's chaotic, but leaving out the fact that it's chaotic, it works pretty well, right? Can we do it for the evolution of the biosphere? No, because new things like swim bladders come up and alter the future evolution in the non-ergodic universe of the evolution of the biosphere. We can't deduce it because new variables sprout up and play causal roles in the unfolding of the biosphere. We can't do what Newton taught us to do. Now, if I'm right about this, this is huge. Of course, I may be wrong, and you may be right. Maybe we can do it. Okay, but I don't think so. Furthermore, I don't see how we can even get started on it. How do we invent a mathematics that can describe the evolution into the unstatable adjacent possible of the biosphere. So now let me throw at you two hypotheses about what this might be like. It might be like Gödel's theorem, and we all know Gödel's theorem. But Gödel's theorem already had a mathematics, it's called arithmetic, from which you could prove theorems. Well, let me back up. How would we prove what I just said? I don't know. Would we do an experiment? That really sounds stupid. Okay. Of course, this room's filled with theoreticians, but I do experiments, okay? If I could do an experiment that would prove this, I would. I mean, the experiment I'm doing is I'm asking lots of people, and it's just not a very good experiment. Would we prove a theorem? So think of Gödel's theorem. But Gödel had the mathematical structure of arithmetic from which he could prove his theorem. What's the mathematical structure of the adjacent possible of the biosphere? I don't have any idea. Maybe there is one. Maybe there's not. I haven't any idea what it would be. Okay? Now let's get to another one. And so you might say, but look, this is sort of like the halting problem. So in the halting problem, and this is the argument I thought up last night. I'm pretty proud of this. Okay, so look, in the halting problem, you say, look, I've got this computer program. I don't know ahead of time what it's going to do. I don't know whether it'll halt or not. So we seem to be confronted by, you know, infinite time goes by, at the end of which, I guess you can't say that. Infinite time goes by. We never know whether it'll halt or not. And then the argument goes, but look, the description of that can't be compressed. So there's no compact description of the behavior of this thing. So maybe what you're talking about is just the halting problem. And I've thought for years that maybe what I was talking about was the halting problem. As of last night, I've come up with an argument why I think it's not the halting problem. Let me give it to you and see what you think. So suppose we've got a Turing machine, and it's got finite, it's got a reading head with finite numbers of states, and it writes with a finite number of states, and it's got the infinite tape, and it goes back and forth playing plonk, 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 plonk. And what we do is we write down the actions of the Turing machine, and we get out some string of symbols, right, of everything that's happened. And as we wait longer and longer and longer, the symbol string gets longer and longer and longer and longer and longer, because it's just this automaton. Now notice that if we ask the following question, please tell me all words length one symbol. We know what all the possibilities are, right? They're all the states of the Turing machine and all of its actions and so on. Suppose we ask, what are all the words length 2 or length L? We know ahead of time what all the possibilities are, don't we? Right? What we don't know is what the infinite sequence of them is. But for any specified L or smaller, we know what they all are. We can define the adjacent possible, or we can define those descriptions. As far as I can see, we can't get started on the adjacent possible of the biosphere. Now, this is contentious, and maybe we can. Okay? I don't see how. So that's my argument, that I don't think that they're the same, but I'm not persuaded. It's just a discussion point right now. So it leads then to the consequence that it's terribly important if it's true, because the same thing's happening in technological evolution. Proof. Jan Rifkin is head of teaching strategy at Harvard Business School. So I asked Jan several months ago, so what do you teach the Harvard MBA students about business strategy? He said, we have no methodology whatsoever. We give them hard case problems and hope they get good at it, that their muscles get strong, so that they can analyze practical problems and find their way through the maze. So I'm going to give a personal example that was fun. Well, I won't take the time to do that because it takes time. Jen and Harvard Business School is proof positive that in the real world of the evolution of the biosphere and in the real world of the evolution of our economy, we do not know what's going to happen. We don't know. Don't know. Now, that means something terribly important to us as human beings. Since the Enlightenment, the highest human virtue, in fact, since the Greeks, The highest human virtue has been reason. I happen to be Jewish. Jews didn't think so much about reason. The big deal was to obey Yahweh, okay? Because he was pretty mean. But the Greeks were rationalists and universalists. And reason is the highest human virtue of the Enlightenment. If what I'm telling you is right, then we confront the fact that the biosphere, where we don't have to worry about consciousness, and us as human beings, live our lives forward without knowing a fair fraction of the time. That means that we have to reunite everything we've got. Reason, emotion, intuition, whatever that is, imagination, whatever that is, allegory, story. However we do it, when you guys are inventing your science, or I'm doing my science, or the businessman is making his judgment, we live forward into what theologian Gordon Kaufman, no relative, says. We live our lives forward into what he calls mystery. And in fact, we do. We live our lives forward into the unknown. So now I'm going to come to the part that I haven't written about. And it's the following. Let me say it, and then we can fight about it later, okay? I know you will. So I actually emailed Weinberg about this, who I've not met, and I told him about Darwinian pre-adaptations, and he says, look, I don't care about prediction. I care about entailment. I want to know that what happens in the unfolding of the universe is entailed by the laws of physics. Well, you could mean this in a strong sense or a weak sense, I guess. Nobody thinks that when the swim bladder emerged, that carbon could just sort of jump and change to nitrogen. Of course the laws of physics, as we know them, are followed. Okay, of course they keep changing, but leaving that out. Nobody thinks that the laws of physics are violated. If that's all he means, that's fine, but it's pretty weak. Okay. It leaves open the possibility that I'm saying that the unfolding of the universe has in it a kind of, I'm going to use the word creativity because I don't know what else to call it, a kind of contingent, perfectly causal, I'm sure there's a causal account, maybe partially quantum account, of the unfolding of the biosphere, but there's no law that describes it sufficiently. And in my new book called Reinventing the Sacred, I use that as a pathway to say, and I'll come to it at the end, we are children of this creativity. All of life is. The evolution of life is. We are children of the partially lawless creativity that is the biosphere and the iconosphere and our culture's unfolding. And I do genuinely want to say that we can think about using the word God to mean that natural agentless creativity. It's sort of a Spinoza kind of view, but it's not quite Spinoza because he was a determinist. This is different. We really seem to be living in a spontaneously creative universe as well as a lawful one. This raises enormous questions if it's right. Not only how would you prove that it's true, but when is it true and why is it true that sometimes you can have laws and sometimes you can't? And are there intermediate cases and what the heck's going on? I don't know, but it's fun and it's fascinating, and some of us are struggling with trying to figure out when and why. So Weinberg otherwise, as I said he cares that physics entails. So the only other sense of entailment that I know is deduction. If it's not deduction, I don't know what entails means. Well, let me rest one bit on the paper, More is Really Different. If that paper is okay, it says, in fact, you cannot deduce the properties of the 2D infinite Ising lattice, like the average magnetization, from knowing the couplings among the spins. I'm resting that on somebody else's work, and I'm not an expert on it. But I don't think you can do it for the evolution of the heart in the non-ergodic universe, either. I don't think it's entailed by physics. Now, that raises a very, very, very interesting new set of questions. Let me be utterly brazen. This is where Lee's right. This is a sort of fearlessness that is, you know, angels, you know, fear, you know, fools rush in where angels fear to tread. But let me do it. The worst that's going to happen is that you're going to tell me I'm utterly wrong. And maybe I am. Suppose that, as a matter of fact, there were a pathway of entailment from wherever we want to start back then, say the Big Bang, to us sitting in this room having this conversation and giving this talk. Then, in that sense, my existence would be explained. I'm entailed by, okay, the wave function of the universe with amplitudes for all possibilities, and so it's faint, but I lucked out. Something like that. Suppose that doesn't work. Suppose reductionism in that sense fails. Then my existence becomes problematic. Why do I exist in the universe? We've got to explain it on a different ground. It's not entailed by physics then, or physics as it stands. Now, before I get to that, I want to talk about something else that's just staggering as you start to think about it. So let me pause and give this to you in the economy. In 1983 in North America, there were television stations, television sets, abundant programming, and couch potatoes, and perforce couches, okay? Was that a good environment to invent the channel changer, and could it make a living?
Yeah.
Right? And it came into existence. And I got one. By the way, and I pointed this out in my talk yesterday, shortly thereafter, the mute button emerged. Okay? And I like to say that the mute button and Facebook are the acme of Western civilization. Okay. So, in 1980, the channel changer was in the adjacent possible of the economy of North America, or 1975. Was it in the adjacent possible of the economy of Europe in the year 1000? No. So something's happening, and we know perfectly well it's happening, we just don't talk about it. The channel changer's in the adjacent possible of the economy. And when it comes to exist, it changes, it becomes actual, and it changes what's in the adjacent possible. The mute button plonked onto the channel changer is now in the adjacent possible, and somebody made money inventing the mute button and patented it, probably, and, you know, probably made a fortune, right? The same thing is happening with the biosphere. As the biosphere evolves and swim bladders come into existence, it changes the adjacent possible of the biosphere, which changes what comes into existence, which changes the adjacent possible of the biosphere. There is, since life persists, a coordinated, not coordinated, but a self-constructing, coordinated becoming of the biosphere and the economy and our culture into a forever adjacent possible. And we have no theory of this at all. We don't know how to talk about it at all. It's this self-consistent coming to be in the universe. Now I want to draw your attention, so this takes really deep biology. Okay, it's about a hummingbird, and her name is Jenny, because it's fun to give names to people in your story. And a field of flowers. So here's what happens. And what happens is actually simple and stunning. Jenny goes to get some nectar from the flower and some pollen rubs off on Jenny's beak. It sticks to her beak. She flies to the next flower, goes to get some nectar, and some of the pollen rubs off of her beak and onto the stamen of the next flower, and Jenny pollinates the second flower, right? Suppose that Jenny had flown to a neighboring tree to enjoy the nectar and all the pollen had fallen off. Or suppose that she had a Teflon beak and all of the, by the way, I actually saw an operation done on a parrot that had lost its beak, and they gave it a plastic beak. So We doctors know how to do things that are important, okay? So suppose that Jenny had a Teflon beak, and before she got out of the first flower, all the pollen fell off. Pollinization of the second flower wouldn't have happened, right? Now, Jenny and the field of flowers, or insects with their hairy legs that also get pollen to stick to them, are literally the conditions of one another's existence in the biosphere. If they didn't do it, they couldn't be mutualists. They are mutualists. They exist by virtue of one another, right? First thing to notice and be astonished by is the stickiness of pollen to the beak. What a quixotic thing to have emerged to be the way that birds and flowers manage to coexist with one another. Isn't that utterly strange? Who would have thought that, right? Who would have ever foretold that? Now, let's suppose that those two things rose as a Darwinian pre-adaptation. They needn't have. Maybe you have birds and flowers, and then somehow it happened. It's happened somehow. So we come to the following. The biosphere is, so let's think about mutualisms. Mutualisms are all over the place in biology and in the economy. So they're complementary goods, like screw and screwdriver, are the conditions, the same thing with the channel changer. The channel changer is the technological complement. It's used together to create value with television stations, programming, couch potatoes, and so on. It creates value used together. Screw and nail are substitutes. Screw and screwdriver are complements. Okay? So complements are mutualists, which create non-zero sum gains. So they make an analog of an autocatalytic set that ecologist Robert Ulanowicz has talked about, in which process A augments process B that augments process C that augments process A. It's another autocatalytic set, except there's no catalysis. Okay? It's just a process. And he tells a lovely story about some sea animal or sea plant that grows some thingies, some fungus on its margin that's eaten by some bugs that in turn is fed upon by the sea plant, and the plant grows the bugs on its surface to bring the things that eat the... So it's a little mutualism, okay? These are the conditions of one another's existence. The entire biosphere, even though things eat things, okay, and they do, is in fact one magnificent mutualism. In which, by the way, autocatalytic sets, as Bob Ulanowicz's point, if this is an autocatalytic system and this is an autocatalytic system, Bob's point is that they direct the flow of matter and energy and activity into themselves. And if they feed off the same resources, they have to compete with one another, whether they're biological or technological. So let me give you a technological one. The car came in and displaced the horse. With it went buggies, buggy whips, saddlery, pony express, and so on. And with the car, you got paved roads, and you got fast food restaurants, and you got an oil industry and a gas industry and motels and suburbia housing people that needed the cars, right? It's an autocatalytic set. It's a set of mutualisms. The car companies in the United States bought up trolley companies in the United States and put them out of business. They were competing autocatalytic systems. The biosphere as a whole and the economy as a whole is some kind of thing, system of processes and objects that are mutually consistent with the existence of one another, except that it keeps unfolding in time, so that cars come in and drive out horses in Schumpeterian gales of creative destruction, and small and large extinction events occur in the biosphere, sometimes because asteroids fall, like at the Permian, at the KT boundary. But probably not all of the time, and some of us have been, you all know self-organized criticality and Per Bach, and some of us fell in love with Per's idea, and I told Per the day I heard it, the biosphere's got little and big extinction events. I wonder if the biosphere is self-organized critical, and there's a minor industry of us for around 10 years making models of the evolution of the biosphere. It turns out that the size distribution of extinction events is power law distributed, and there's now a bunch of models that give you that. By the way, Schumpeterian gales of creative destruction are also power law distributed, and we've recently published a paper that deduces that. So that's also interesting because it says that while we may not know in detail what will come into existence in the economy or in the biosphere, we can still get statistical laws. Well, that's helpful. So I'm going to close. I think that what I've said is right. It may not be. If it is right, then we really have to rethink things. First of all, it's going to require intense examination to decide, is it true? How would we prove it? Namely, that we can't restate the adjacent possible of the biosphere, that there is no sufficient law for its becoming. If it's true, it beats what we have believed since Descartes. That's huge. So not to be taken lightly, not just Stukoff and stands up and says it, but to be examined carefully. Maybe it ties into more is really different. I think that's very worth thinking about. It's as if different probes are coming at us from different directions saying some fundamental things that we've been thinking about are wrong. I will note to you that life has changed the character of the Earth, right? It's a non-equilibrium atmosphere, for example. That, therefore, changes in some ways the behavior of the solar system and presumably the galaxy. If so, the theory of everything doesn't seem to entail it. Tough luck. Isn't that fascinating? So we've got all sorts of new stuff to do. I think we need a new enlightenment. I think we really do live forward into mystery. To say the spiritual part, I'm happy with the notion of a natural God as the creativity in the universe. I think from that we need to construct a sense of the sacred, which I think is all of planet, all of life on the planet, of which we are the children, to be slightly preacher-like. If this view is right, we're not made in God's image. We too are God. But then so is the lichen and I guess the rocks. From that, I hope that we can get to a global ethic, because the global civilization's emerging. We are so secularized. You know, you can't say spiritual, and you can't say God, because we all know about the Inquisition, and we all know about Galileo. And for 150 years, it has been anathema to admit to the fact that we're also spiritual beings. We can be spiritual. We don't have to re-invoke the Inquisition. We don't have to have a theistic God. I mean, I don't believe in God. So I want to say on the spiritual side that I think that it's time that we did that, because I don't think that we have a global ethic. I think we're reduced to commodities. In fact, somebody was telling me today that there's an effort to see friendship in terms of in a Coasean sense, of coordination costs. What a stupid thing to do with human relationships. We've got emotions that have to do with friendships, not coordination costs. Okay? So there's a lot hanging on this. One is, I think we have to reintegrate our entire humanity. No culture has ever done it. We have to put it all together. We have to put Einstein and Shakespeare in the same room, not the two cultures. We haven't any idea what that means. If this is right, we really have to profoundly rethink science. Maybe there really is emergence and an incapacity to infer from or deduce from the lower levels to the higher levels. Then maybe it really is true, as I've tried to assert, that understanding how come we exist is an utterly legitimate question. And then I guess I really will end with the last thing I want to say. I have a dream. And the dream is that biospheres evolve in such a way that on average, the diversity of organized processes that can happen in them is maximized. I don't know if that's true. It's just so pretty. Okay, so I like that a lot. Thank you. Gosh, I knew you'd ask a question.
Go ahead. Well, first of all, I actually am not a reductionist and sympathetic to these arguments. My comment is that a lot of people like George Ellis, Paul Beattie, John Fulton, they'd be saying very similar things. It's been in theological literature for quite a while as well.
Right.
So in that sense, I don't want to denigrate what you're saying, but it's not new in that regard. In fact, many people that are friends of mine, they've always thought physicists are stupid for thinking everything is reductionist, because to many people it's so obviously not. But that being said, I'll try and defend reductionism. In the sense that what I don't understand in what you're saying, amongst other things, we don't know how to specify a set of adjacent possibilities. But a hardcore reductionist would say, well, that's just because we haven't done enough work yet. Give us enough time, give us enough effort. The idea, if I understand it, is that we in fact will one day be able to specify the set of adjacent possibilities in biology or wherever. So what I don't understand is why you think we can't. I mean, everybody would agree we don't know how now, but you seem to be saying in principle we're not able to, but I don't understand what the obstruction is in doing that.
So let me partially try to defend what I'm saying by slightly shifting gears. Let's suppose that because I understand classical physics and only partially quantum physics, but I know what a six-dimensional phase space is. Because it's got six end dimensions. And you say to me, but look, Kaufman, or Stu. By the way, the right attack, if you were a British philosopher, but surely Kaufman. That's simply untrue.
So, not a Brit.
Yeah. So suppose we have some vast six end dimensional phase space that includes, say, the solar system. And then you say, look, the biosphere is just some subspace of this vast space. So we know the phase space of the biosphere. It's just this subspace of this space. And I say, yeah, that's fine. Now pick out swim bladders. And you have no way to pick out collective degrees of freedom that are causally relevant in the evolution of the biosphere. So knowing the phase space doesn't help you at all. It's utterly useless. Now, I think what you have to say is, I don't think knowing the phase space helps you. I think you have to be able to say something about the trajectory through the phase space that constitutes biological evolution. Okay? I don't see how you're going to do it. Okay? Leaving out for the moment more is
why.
Really,
like, what is it when you say I can't? Is it because it's too complicated? Is it what is the instruction?
One defense is the paper that I just read yesterday. More is really different. If that paper's right, it does really seem to say that if you can map Turing machines to the lattice, then you can't say the macroscopic properties and the microscopic properties are not derivable. So, it's worth examining that. So that seems to be in principle, okay? But the other part is, I don't know how to prove, I can't answer you. I don't know how, and there's a bunch of reasons. I don't know how to prove that we can't. I don't know, as a matter of fact, what would constitute a proof. A proof seems to be either some experiment that you would do, I have no idea what the experiment is. Or it would seem to be mathematical proof, and we know what those are. But then we would seem to need something about some sort of mathematical structure from which we could derive such a proof. And right now, I haven't the faintest idea what that is. So if you say to me, maybe someday we'll be able to, I can't disprove it. But maybe this article does.
Or I could go on.
I'd just like to bring up something. How many people have heard of the game of life? Not the board game, but the cellular automata thing. Okay.
Everybody.
So yeah, all right, good. So the game of life is 2D cellular automata, and it evolves in time. Cells are either alive or dead, and there's rules that determine that. And you start with some initial state, and you let it go. It's a completely determined system. Everything, you know exactly what's going to happen in another cell based on the previous time step. Jacobian, you don't have any memory. You know, everything about it, it's fully describable, yet you get emergent properties from it. So here's a system that is completely...
And it's computationally universal.
I'm getting there.
Oh.
So here's a system that is completely specified, absolutely, 100%. You specify everything about it in very simple rules. Yet, when you run the simulations, you see things. Things emerge, things like gliders, these little structures that propagate themselves. And then you might ask yourself, you know, before you run this, are you asking yourself, well, are we going to see gliders? Well, I don't know, maybe some people are. So it's something of a simple question if you study another cellular concept. But imagine once you see gliders, you can say, well, are there things that create gliders? And there are. There's these structures called glider guns, and they just shoot out gliders in a certain direction. And so, but now you can ask, all right, these glider guns exist. They're a structure that we recognize. When you're looking just at the laws, would you have asked a question like, do glider guns exist? Well, now we're getting further away from things that are real, yet we made a step through gliders. And so now it's a reasonable question. This is similar to your argument. So now that we have glider guns, what can we do with it? Well, we can have them interact in a way that you know, actually computes. And it turns out that if you arrange glider guns in a certain way and start with a particular initial state, you can do any computation that you want. So furthermore, you can even simulate a game of life on this simulated computer. So now you have multiple structures, et cetera. And once you have universal computation, you have indeterminism. So you have questions that you can ask about programs, which are now translated to initial states of the system, so that even though you know the laws, you can't say what is actually going to happen in the end. So, I mean, for instance, you could say, well, you know, if I put this initial state, and here's something that the reductionist should pay close attention to. If I have an initial state, what's going to happen? Yes, you can run the simulation and say exactly what's going to happen. But if you don't interpret it right, you may not be answering the same question that someone with a question in the language of emergence might be asking. For instance, if you're looking at a computation that's being simulated in the game of life, then you might say, well, I want to calculate, you know, the first 20 digits of the square root of 2. Okay, you can do that. You can write a program that does that. You can do it on the game of life, and you can go through the steps. All right, now take that same initial state, give it to a reductionist, and say, I want you to predict the outcome of this. Are they going to tell you? It's going to tell you the first 20 digits of the square root of 2. No, probably not. They're just going to run the thing, see the big answer, and you know, not get the connection. So,
one thing, being explicit about the connection. The connection is the semantics.
Exactly. That's
the connection is the semantics.
That's my point. You're asking a question in a language.
This constitutes the square root of
the
state.
That's right. So you're asking a question in a language that talks about, you know, it's the language of the simulated computation.
Right.
We could go back one level and talk about the language of gliders and glider guns. A glider is, it's not even a thing. It's just a collection of little, you know, a particular collection of cells that are on or off in a configuration. But we talk about it in that language, and we talk about glider guns in another language. So if you're asking a question in this language, this high-level language, which is what you're doing, and you want an answer in that language, I think what is true is that even if you have the underlying laws for what the stuff is made out of, you can't always go through them to find your answer. In fact, you may not even be able to state the question, which is what you're saying.
Right.
So the game of life is a very good example of this.
And who was the guy that I had lunch with yesterday? Chris, what's his name? Elias Smith? Yeah, so Chris has an interesting argument about reductionism. His thing, I won't get it quite straight, and you seriously could ask him. But his statement is that when you try to reduce the higher level laws to the lower level laws, you need to state conditions about the context of the higher level laws. And his example is the heart. Well, without the evolutionary story, the example he gave me, is that you can see that the heart's pumping blood. Harvey did. A long time before the theory of evolution, okay? And I guess Chris's claim is that you have to have statements in the higher level language that allow you to say the heart's pumping blood. And you can't get rid of those statements and translate them to a lower level language. You're always stuck with statements in the higher level language. But Chris should be here to really defend that. But it's a pretty interesting line of thought.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, I have a lot of comments, but let me limit them to two. One is that the mute button was in the adjacent console long before it was invented, because I used to hate commercials and I built something.
But you invented it!
Well, it was a hardware with long wires and a switch to the loudspeaker that you could turn off the commercials.
Well, that's good. You could sit in your you couch potato and go on. Cool. You should have patented it.
I guess so.
They did have remote controls in Europe.
They didn't.
In the year 1000 AD, they were just called rock fruit.
More slaves.
The second is, I mean, I'm sympathetic to a lot of things you say. For example, I believe that it's true that there's genuine novelty in the world or in the world process, whatever you want to call it. But I don't quite recognize the image of science and reductionism that you seem to be attacking.
Okay.
It seems to me it's very much of a straw person, that real science as we know it, reductionist science, is much closer to what you're aiming at, I think, or advocating, than you're granting. So even in the Laplacian determinism, that was only determinism if you knew the initial state. The
sure.
whole question of whether life exists is a question, even in that context, about the initial state.
Sure.
And there was no answer was provided within that. No lawful answer was provided that would have told you
about the initial life, state.
What about the initial state? So
yeah.
even in that very strict form of determinism, there was no law governing whether or not life exists. A more modern example is cosmology, right? I mean.
Mm-hmm.
We look what people try to do in cosmology. They try to predict the power spectrum of this cosmic microwave background. Those are certain statistical regularities. No one remotely says, can we predict the location, the number of galaxies, exactly the location of every galaxy, or every detail of the fluctuations
yeah.
of the right. microwave background radiation, or anything like that. So.
Mm-hmm.
I think people are not, of course, cosmology is a place where history plays a greater role than some
sure.
other things, but I don't think anyone would demand to predict you or predict the heart or something. But if you could understand things well enough to say, well, there should be something like life,
mm-hmm.
that would satisfy, I think, almost anyone. And you yourself gave an example of how you might derive such a theorem. So I don't
yeah.
see, I don't see this, I'm not quite sure what you're attacking, basically.
So I guess I'm attacking. So first of all, I think it's true that real physicists, of whom there are many in this room, I mean, if molecular biologists, of which I'm one, sort of, are the most naive reductionists in the world. We think that there's these little hard balls that bump into one another, and we draw pictures of them, and they have shapes and little triangles cut out of them, or other triangles fit in, and stuff like that. I think real physics is much more fluid and open than Laplace's demon, of course. But it's still true, and I know numbers of examples of people who would hold to the view that's a modern version of Laplace's demon. It would be something like there's a wave function of the universe, and there's an amplitude for all possible social systems. I have the faintest idea what that statement means.
But is that a statement of, well, I don't either, but is that a statement of reductionism? I'm not sure what, I'm
well,
not sure why.
No, it's, you know, I mean, that would be, you know, I mean, Marie Gell-Mann and Jim Harder would say there's a wave function of the universe, then they'd go through their decohering histories and all that stuff that you guys understand and I don't. And it just, There is this other Rorvian point that I think maybe we shouldn't ignore. After all, as a biological fact, we've evolved and split off from the great apes and invented language. Neat. Why are we certain that we can describe all of reality? I mean, why should we be? So let me come back to it. You're saying that it's a side point and not a side point. There may be something absolutely profound in what Rorty is saying. And Wittgenstein told us when he talked about language games, not being reducible to one another.
This sounds like more anti-science than just anti-reductionism. It's no. Some sentence, it's a stronger attack.
But you know,
I mean, there's some things we can't understand. But we won't know until we try.
And
one language is not necessarily adequate.
Yeah, maybe we need another.
So
yeah.
Yeah,
one language may not be adequate. So you see, what I'm saying is not anti. I think what I've said is not anti-science at all. It's an invitation to something very much richer, in my view. Okay, let me put it this way. When Lady Macbeth says, out, out, damned spot, Shakespeare's telling the truth. That's how people work. Right? And we know perfectly well why Lady Macbeth is saying, out, out, damned spot, on multiple levels of narrative. Right? So part of what I want to say is that in ways that I think we don't even begin to understand, scientific enterprise that we adore, and I've been a scientist for 45 years, that we adore, is also a human adventure that we're, in ways that I think we don't understand, we are in liaison with the business person trying to decide whether or not to invest in fiber optic cables. That was my story. They actually consulted with me when I was at Santa Fe Institute for $5,000. About whether to put in fiber optic cables. And they said they'd give me $5,000, and I said, I'm not going to put $5,000 is $5,000. So they came to me and they told me, spell south, and they told me about it all day. And I said, gee, that's interesting. I didn't know about boundary. And at the end of the day, honest to gosh, I said to them, well, how do you know some kid won't come up with an idea and a way of using BB guns to keep tin cans up in the air and bounce signals around the earth on these tin cans? And they looked at me like I was nuts and gave me my $5,000. I cashed it as fast as I could. And they invested billions of dollars in fiber optic cables. And 4 years later, they put up satellites and bounced signals around the world, and the guys lost billions of dollars. Did they know? They didn't. Okay, were they stupid? No. They were wrong. So if this is right, maybe we have to give up the view that there shall be, when the science shall have been done, something that links us all the way up. I mean, let's see, we understand this picture. We understand the picture. I'm sorry, I don't mean anything, but we understand the picture that you're pointing at. It is the reductionist picture, and there's what's down there, string theory or quantum gravity, may you find it. God bless you, I hope you do. My God. Okay, actually, he can't bless. Okay. Yahweh bless you. I really hope you guys work out quantum gravity. And then there's this chain all the way up to, as Weinberg says, explanatory arrows all point downward, from societies to people parts to cells, to biochemistry to chemistry to physics, and of course, to particle physics. And we feel really comfortable with that. We understand what it might be for it all to be explained in E.O. Wilson's Consilience. Maybe it's much richer than that. Maybe it doesn't hang together the way we have thought since Newton. Maybe the universe becomes in ways that we don't know how to talk about, and we have to invent a post-reductionist science to go along with reduction. If so, it's an amazing adventure. We don't even know how to get started on it. But pieces of it have to do, I think, with the question of how come the hummingbird and the flower exist in the universe? How come they coherently invade the adjacent possible and build that which comes next? Because they do. They do, really. So it may be the case that ultimately when the science shall have done, that we can do it. I want you to bet not, okay? And the closest thing, I suppose, is what do you make of More is Really Different?
It's a really good thing.
It's gotten better. it's gotten better in the last half hour. Do you think they're right?
Well, you have to be careful with what you're asking me if they're saying. I mean, they make a very specific claim, which is that when you have when everything about a system can be described in, you know, a few lines on a piece of paper, which is what they have, then you would think, based on, you know, our training and analysis and physics, that we should be able to derive laws from that. And in condensed matter physics, you frequently find yourself using approximations like the infinite limit, this sort of thing, to talk about things like magnetization or phase transitions, critical points. We use these tools a lot. And what it shows is that the tools fail.
Right.
In general. There exist systems. Yeah. There exist systems for which the tools fail.
Right.
Now, does that mean that you can't, that if you were to simulate this system on a computer and, you know, give it, you know, heaps of memory and lots of time, that it would, that you couldn't do it? No. I mean, you'll get an answer. You'll get data. You can simulate it. You know what the laws are. But it says that the analytical tools that we like to use and the way that we like to think about deriving macroscopic properties from microscopic properties does not work in all cases. So yes, that has been proven.
Okay. Any other questions? Yes.
This business about a post-reductionist slide. So I just wonder to what extent, you know, evolutionary biology is currently practiced or economics is currently practiced by all ways.
We've already
in a lot of ways they're not professionals.
That's right. They're not. So they're not.
It's not only to be embedded, I mean they're making new insights.
I agree with you. I mean economics, while modeled on physics in many ways, is currently at its own level. And evolutionary biologists have been doing very well, thank you. They're called paleontologists, figuring out what Darwinian pre-adaptations are. So that's true. Okay. I think what's striking me is if we are not impaled by the laws of physics, then the grounds of our existence in the universe requires a different explanation. Okay. And it's in that sense that I invite us to think about an open universe in which the existence of us, and I'm going to give you a very funny little, I don't know what to do with this, okay, but I'm going to give it to you. We are also taught that big things are made up of little things which are made up of littler things all the way down to the littlest things, right? In the 1600s, the Dutch invented the stock company. And you could issue Series B preferred stock. I know, I just bought Series B preferred stock in Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. I've lost a bunch of money. I'm like, this is not a happy story. There's,
there goes the 5,000.
Huh? What?
There goes the 5,000.
Yeah, I blew the 5,000 plus on that one. Now, this is interesting because Series B preferred stock is not made up of stock, right? What's going on? Okay, so you say, well, it depends on human consciousness, well, it does, and whatever that is, and it depends upon contracts and laws and courts and all of that machinery, and it does. But it exists in the universe, and if you don't think so, watch people buying and selling Series B stock and running around and running up to the broker and handing over money, and it changes what's happening in the universe. So don't tell me Series B stock doesn't exist in the universe. It's changing what happens. Okay, it does. And it's not made up of parts. Okay? So there's things that it seems to me that we don't quite know how to think about it. And maybe analogically, but more than analogically, there is a profound sense in which the hummingbird and the flower have a contract too. Okay? Of course, there's no law. But it's enforced by existence, okay? One better pollinate and the other better feed. Otherwise it doesn't work. So these are all related. Notice, by the way, that these are all relational, okay? We're not going to account for these things without being relational. So, at about this point, I get confused. I get even more confused.
I think we should probably, thanks to again.
Here's 4 days.
I'll be here tomorrow.
And everyone can find me.
Thank you all.